You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 17th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow, the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the sudden failure of one of the major supposed empirical talking points that have brought us the austerity era we are living in at here and abroad. The Reinhard Rogoff papers, books, study is shown to be based on really crappy arithmetic, apparently. A spreadsheet failure. Mike Consigal from the Roosevelt Institute will be joining us to discuss. Really stunning. You may not recognize the name of that study, ladies and gentlemen, but believe me, you are aware of its finding, and it has influenced almost every aspect of our politics, if not having been used as a fig leaf for our politics. And you know how awkward it can be when you rip off that fig leaf, what's underneath, so to speak. Also on the program today, not much new in terms of information on the Boston Marathon bombing, but some. We now, in many respects, still are clear on what we don't know. Also, a senator, and now it's just breaking, President Obama, receiving, or I should say, packages intercepted, or letters intercepted to them, are found in one case to contain or test positive, I should say, for ricin. And suspicion about the second one to President Obama. Federal authorities saying they know who sent these. So the ricin, of course, is also there can be a lot of false positives, but this is a developing story. Not sure that it's related. Meanwhile, on other fronts, President Obama issues a veto threat against CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, saying that he's concerned it does not protect individuals' privacy and civil liberties enough, which has surprised people, and that in and of itself is a statement that it would surprise people. And President Obama also signs the repeal of the Stock Act, which was passed in the Senate and the House over the past couple of days by simple voice vote. You'll remember the Stock Act. It's the one that said that we must make it difficult for lawmakers to trade on inside information that they gain by being lawmakers. Well, that passed with some fanfare a couple of years ago, and it goes away in 2 years. I mean, essentially, they had a moratorium, a brief time out from using inside information to make money, and now that's gone away. Also, Republicans fighting against gateway sexual activities. And Mark Sanford busting through his own gateways, much to his detriment. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Consigal. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program after really too long, ladies and gentlemen. Mike Consigal, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Welcome to the program, Mike.
It has been too long. Thanks for having me on.
Let me just say that I am very proud of the fact that on this program we're going to be able to spend as much time to something that some people would perceive as an obscure fight that is taking place in sort of very narrow economic circles. But the implications of the Rogoff-Reinhart study have been rather large in terms of the shadow that study has cast on our policies and or at least the justifications for our policies, and specifically the austerity, the policies of austerity that we have been subjected to in this country and in Europe, frankly, over the past couple of years. Just tell us what the Rogoff-Reinhart study is.
So Kenneth Rogoff is an economist at Harvard, also with the IMF. He was very affiliated with the IMF. Carmen Reinhart is also an economist. They wrote a paper in 2010. Now, if you remember back to 2010, there was a big debate about should there be an additional round of stimulus, what should be done in Europe in particular. And they wrote a paper that said if you get above 90% debt to GDP, which is to say if your debt's approaching what you make in 1 year, which is what the U.S. Debt was approaching and soon would have come to, and what Europe had already gone past, you have a real decline in growth. The growth drops off from what it would normally be. On average, which this is one of their big headline reports, is that it would go negative. And crucially, they pitched this as almost like a cliff, right? Like it was a zone that once you were in, it wasn't that it just got a little bit worse. It got significantly worse. So it was really a danger zone to be avoided. This had a real outsized impact on the debate and convinced, I mean, there's a lot of people who wanted austerity and were willing to take whatever excuse they had. But I think there's a lot of, like, especially centrist Democrats who were nervous about stimulus and nervous about debt to GDP. And this gave them an excuse to go much harder against, trying to do something about unemployment and slow growth.
Tim Fernholz recounts a passage from a book by Senator Tom Coburn on U.S. debt. And he recounts the time where Rogoff and Reinhart met with 40 senators. I mean, that's, 40 senators. That's a big deal in 2011. And the exchanges that took place there where Rogoff, where Johnny Isaacson said, do we need to act this year? Is it better to act quickly? Absolutely, Rogoff said. Not acting moves the risk closer. You have very few levers at this point, he warned us. It went on to say that Kent Conrad seemed to really absorb what Rogoff was saying, that this was going to diminish our GDP, our growth, rather, by 25 to 33%. You had Tim Geithner, who was the Secretary of Treasury at the time, saying it's an excellent study, although in some ways maybe it's understated. He lists all of it. That 90% threshold is cited in Paul Ryan's budget. European Commissioner Olli Rehn cites it. I mean, on and on and on. It's cited over and over again. And I will just tell you that from a non-sort of like policy perspective, my brother-in-law, who, you know, God bless him, is, absorbs things rather quickly, and is a business guy, considers himself one of those sort of non-ideological people, states this over and over again, this mantra. I don't know if he knows the names Rogoff and Reinhardt, but this has had incredible impact, at least in our politics, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then remember, there isn't, like, you know, events like the Great Depression, like the Great Recession we just went through, don't happen very often, right? So we often don't know about what happens to economies when they go into it. So, I mean, even though the conventional sense is still true, right? Like the Federal Reserve is having trouble acting, so fiscal stimulus, we know, will boost employment. The idea of debt really far out there is kind of unknown, right? The last time the United States had this was during the end of the Great Depression, when we were ramping up for World War II and also had massive full employment and perfect growth. So there's not really like a good set of data sets. So the fact that two really, you know, preeminent economists really put this out there, and then also they're denying this now, aggressively put muscle into it. I mean, as you said, they met with 40 senators, which how often do people get to meet with 40 senators, is really telling me. It was really an important intellectual building block of the global movement towards austerity in the early 2010s.
Okay, so now you write a piece yesterday that basically summarizes in some respects a study by three economists from UMass, and people referring to them as HAM. It essentially takes apart the Reinhardt Rogoff study, and other people have done that in the past, and we'll talk about the problems they've had. But why don't you list for us who it was that did that study and what they found and why? Why their study is unique in terms of having access to the original data?
So there was always a question about the causation, right? You always hear correlations, not causation. The correlation they found, there was always a big debate about whether or not Reinhardt and Rogoff were essentially reading their results backwards, and whether or not a weak economy was causing higher debt, which makes perfect sense. But no one had been able to reproduce the data or reproduce their results. Most of the data, in fact, all of it by now, has been publicly available, but their methodology is really opaque in the paper. They don't use all the data. It's not clear how they do stuff. And so no one's actually been able to replicate it, to take apart the pieces and show, you know, reporters who are very influenced by this results how it works. Finally, three researchers at UMass Amherst, Thomas Hernan, Michael Ash, and Robert Pollan, brilliant economists. They were able to get one of them spent basically a year trying to reverse engineer it, could not do it. So they finally got them, Reinhardt and Rogoff, to send their original spreadsheet. And then it was very clear what they were doing and why no one was able to replicate it.
Okay, so let's go through. There were essentially three problems they found with the Reinhardt-Rogoff study, and the sort of save the most sort of like spectacular one, I guess, and the most flamboyant error for last. It may be the least significant in some respects, but in other respects, I happen to think it's the most significant. But take us through those three problems that they found.
Sure. So the first two have to do with the data. Reinhardt and Rogoff do not use periods in the 1940s and the early 1950s for several countries that have both high debt loads and high growth. Canada is one. New Zealand, they exclude all the years that were high growth and high debt and just took the last year, which actually had very low growth, like negative 7%, like a very severe recession. New Zealand's a very small country even at that point, so the fact that they're weighing it against the United States, for instance, I think is really problematic. But crucially, they exclude certain years in a way that seems incredibly problematic. The second is that
I just want to dwell on that for a second so that people understand what you're saying here is that they have theoretically the data set that they can use, right, goes back, I guess, 100 to 115 years or so, and they choose specific data set that – that seems pretty arbitrary and capricious, right? I mean, it's like why this year as opposed to that year? Could anybody make any heads or tails about it when they've responded to this? I mean, do they explain why we chose to use these years and not those years?
Especially for their headline results, the one that all the congressmen were worried about, they look from essentially the mid 40s onward. So it's only 100, I think it's 110 data points that are actually really high debt of you know, 20 countries or so. And they throw out 15 immediately. So this is a substantial part of the set, right? This is, you know, about 10 or 15% of the data set is tossed. And they all tend to be years with high growth and high debt. And it's, I mean, that's really problematic. I mean, it's very obvious, and it has a significant effect on the final thing.
It's very problematic.
Now, the second thing they do is they weigh it in such a way, which is to say, you know, it's always difficult. You have to, as you know, someone who's working with data, you have to make decisions about what counts and what doesn't and how you're, you know, weighing things or what are you trying to compare. They compare countries overall. So, for instance, the 1 year of New Zealand they find that's really bad is given the equal weight of 19 years in England, in the UK, that has, you know, 2.5% growth on average. It's actually a pretty good run of high debt for them. And they say, you know, one's negative 7%, one's 2.5%, therefore, you know, it averages out to negative 4% or whatever it would be. Negative 3% because it has equal weighting. It's a really obtuse way to weight it, and it's obviously the weighting you'd use if you really wanted to amplify small and consequential one-off years, like from a small country like New Zealand.
I am not good at math, and I can't imagine anyone I know whose abilities in these areas is less than mine, who's willing to actually even entertain a conversation about it. But it seems to me that if you have 19 years of a major, one of the largest economies in the world, functioning with high debt and high growth, and to give that equal balance as New Zealand's 1 year of high debt, negative growth, that just seems... It just seems bizarre to me. How do they justify that?
Well, they dance around it. They haven't particularly responded. I mean, they've just sent out another thing a little while ago. I'm trying to argue about this. I think so. I mean, we'll talk about the third thing as well. On one hand, you could make an argument for why this might be a good way to weigh it. But the two things that should stand out is one is that they didn't disclose that they were doing this. They did not make their techniques and methodology available to other people. You know, people like Dean Baker, a prominent liberal think tanker, have been asking for years about their methodology and their data, and they've just ignored it. So, if you know, transparency is ultimately a good disinfectant here. And so the fact that they weren't disclosing it, and once people started to be able to see what was going on, it was very clear how problematic it was. And it means that they ultimately should have been hedging these statements that they were making to people like senators, people like journalists. I mean, these results were widely cited by journalists, which is how it circulated into the greater kind of public discourse, which is why random people would know about this. The fact that stuff was missing and the third error makes it really, I mean, it's really problematic.
Yes, let's talk about the third error because in some ways I think the policy wonks and experts are saying this actually has the smallest impact on their findings. But in my estimation, it's going to have the largest political impact.
Right. So what happens is they actually did this in an Excel spreadsheet, and the researchers were able to get a hold of the Excel spreadsheet. And it should be worth noting one more time that people have been trying very hard to replicate these results, and they couldn't. And one reason they couldn't is because the research actually drops 5 countries of the results. And remember that they're averaging by country, so they essentially drop another 16 results. Now, they drop it because they accidentally mistype something into an Excel formula. So next video is where my write-up of it is. I actually was able to get a snapshot from the authors of the actual error. And you can see that, you know, the blue box, if you use Excel every day to do office supplies or your home budget or whatever it is, the blue box is supposed to average all the countries, and they only average, I think, 15 out of the 20 countries.
Now, can I just say that I find Excel spreadsheets to be a huge pain. But I mean, this, you know, that's, I don't have cause to use them in the way that necessarily, how does something like that happen? I mean, don't theoretically they have, research assistants who say, hey, you know what? There's 20, you should be, averaging 20 countries, and it seems like you're only averaging 15. How does that happen?
So one reason it happens is because these, you know, the methodology and the data was not peer reviewed or released for public comment. I mean, Dean Baker would have caught that in 30 seconds if it was published. You know, the researchers at Amherst, Ash, Pollan, and Herzon, like, found it very quickly. The other thing, I mean, just as a practical matter, if you're in Excel and you're constantly adding data or removing data, sometimes things don't update when you think they did. It's conceptually easy to see how they could screw it up, but it's really unforgivable that this was not available for public discourse. I think a lot of people, in practice, that doesn't matter too much, right? So the actual results, it does have a significant change. And a lot of people, and it, obviously the fact that the results that the researchers find is very dependent on the data sources and the weighting. But I think it's important to emphasize, I mean, you know, this argument has justified 30% unemployment in Spain. It's justified the sequestration, which is leading to Medicare cuts. It's justified a grand bargain by President Obama that's going to slash Social Security for elderly widows. Like, it's the intellectual foundation for some really terrible stuff in the world. And the fact that when you really look at it, I mean, it's just goofy. The kind of stupid mistakes that were made, I think people should really understand what the clay feet, the kind of emperor has no clothes of this austerity movement.
Yeah, I mean, what's fascinating to me about this is that, this study, I've interviewed many economists, and this study has come up. I mean, I just interviewed Mark Blythe last week, and when I say Reinhard Rogoff, he, you know, quickly dismissed it for the causal connections and for saying that the data is a little bit dicey. There seems to have been, I mentioned this to Bill Black the other day before this stuff came out. He had the same response. There has been a consistent, you know, Krugman has been out there for some time. Obviously, Dean Baker. In many respects, it seems to me that there was at least, if not a broad consensus, there was some significant consensus that this study was problematic, particularly from the perspective of it being of the causal relationship. And in fact, I think in the first response that Reinhart and Rogoff sent after your piece came out, was something to the effect of, like, we never pushed the causal connection.
An association was their word.
Yes. And that is, you know, I mean, anybody can make associations, right? I mean, that's also, you know, it just so happened that this was a period of time where, you know, cars were really popular. I mean, But what's fascinating,
when people carry umbrellas, it causes it to rain, right?
Right. That's just an association. Exactly. And what's fascinating to me about this is that within it is the Excel spreadsheet mistake, I think, you know, despite the fact that represents in terms of the actual computations a relatively minor problem for their computations, it seems like that's going to be the thing that actually has the most political currency.
Well, I think I think the fact that, well, it's tough to tell what's going to travel with people. I think to general readers, I think they're just, I think there's something comical about it, but I think there's also kind of evidence of sloppiness, something that was not caught. Like from a higher end econometric results, like, you know, maybe you should be able to throw out data by randomness, which is clearly what they did. I mean, it's random by the alphabet. But I think it's a good immediate cue that something went wrong. This was not quality controlled. It was not peer reviewed. It was not opened up to a group of their peers to be examined and, you know, cross examined. So I do actually think that it's worthwhile to have it as a good marker, though understanding, I put an update in my write up, and then the authors from Amherst themselves strictly emphasize that, you know, the other things are really the selective data and the unconventional weighting are really what's kind of tilting this into negative territory for them.
I want to just sort of transition this conversation slightly to a piece that Peter Fraze, I think I'm maybe mispronouncing his name, from the sociology department at the CUNY Graduate Center, wrote about the perils of wonkery in regards to this, because the Reinhart-Rogoff study sort of traveled a lot through the sort of wonk journalist osphere, if you will. And in many respects, just when you present the findings of this piece and say, you know, on the other hand, there are some people like Paul Krugman or Dean Baker who say, the causal implications of this are a little bit off. He criticizes them for I guess, you know, something that we've mentioned on this program, that, you know, there's a hidden ideology there in this type of journalism. And I think this aspect of it with the Excel spreadsheet sort of brings that out, because it just seems to me that you will never see on television, or you will never see in the debates that take place where the rubber meets the road, where, you know, if Paul Krugman sits down with Paul Ryan and debates Rogoff Reinhart yesterday, or 2 days ago, it gets into the weeds and people lose sight of it. If he says they couldn't even get an Excel spreadsheet to work, the conversation's over. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about this to me.
Right. So Peter Fraze, who is also an editor at a magazine called Jacobin, wrote the piece essentially argues a couple of things. But one thing is that wonk bloggers, or basically any reporter who talks about policy for a living, is uniquely suited for kind of something some people call source capture, which is that they're very dependent on the people they're reporting on to influence how they understand things, right? A lot of journalists will not have academic training, nor should they. But if they're writing on a very complicated economic issue, they're going to have to rely on economists, particularly the people who are involved with that debate, for guidance. And, you know, or they're reading papers, and they can read the, you know, introduction, conclusion, and kind of the headline results, but they can't quite, they don't have the sophistication to understand the little miniature debates that are really deep in there. I mean, that's a problem for all journalism, and it's a problem in part for this. The political consequences, as you alluded to and Peter does, is that especially when you're dealing with like the deficit or economists who often are kind of reactionary, the consensus is between a very kind of deficit hawk neoliberalish view and then a like super reactionary conservative view. So like actual genuine, you know, progressivism is like completely missing from the dialogue, right? Krugman is thankfully a breath of fresh air on this stuff. But like, you know, when you read economists on the deficit, some think we need immediate austerity and some think, you know, we need mild austerity as opposed to like, don't care about the deficit, give everyone a job and the deficit will take care of itself, which is actually the correct answer. But, you know, that's not necessarily the elite opinionated, like serious answer, which is what will then inform the journalism. And Reinhart and Rogoff are like ground zero for their paper in particular is ground zero for that kind of seriousness. We need to, you know, be willing to take a lot of pain to make sure the deficit stays still. You know, that kind of journalism, which is one reason why I think this report percolated so far across the entire public sphere.
I mean, it's interesting, and I don't want to be hyperbolic about this, but in some respects, we can see the same sort of dynamic. I mean, there's a certain sort of structural issue here, as it was with Iraq in some way. There's a certain amount of credentialism that is involved here. And when two esteemed economists from Harvard say this is what it is, it is risky for you to maintain your status as someone who is taken seriously, because you need to be taken seriously on both ends of it, right? You need to be taken seriously by your audience, and you need to be taken seriously by your sources. And on some level, there's a balancing act there. And the way that you're taken seriously by your audience is to be, in some ways, taken seriously by your sources. And it's this sort of credentialism that is sort of embedded in there. And particularly if you are one of those people who don't necessarily have the ability to sort of say, like, you know, I've broken down your spreadsheet and there's a problem here. So you have to almost take what they're saying. To me, it seems to really be a very strong argument, again, for transparency, because this is always, it's that black box that always seems to bring us to this point.
And transparency, you know, it's even worse, and this is an analogy to the Iraq War where source capture was definitely in play, is the elite self-policing is just broken down, right? Like, Reinhardt and Rogoff are not going to be reprimanded by the economist professions, right? Where other kinds of, like, you know, scientists, like biologists, if they try to, you know, move really bad data on other biologists, will be, like, punished for it in hard or soft ways. You know, how many economists thought Wall Street was going to deliver all this prosperity in the 2000s, or thought the recession would be no big deal, or freaked out about the deficit, all of which turned out to be absolutely wrong. And, you know, no one's lost their jobs. No one's been punished, you know, in any, even in a social way. And the same thing with Iraq, right? All the warmongers who were, you know, were cheerleading the drum march to war, or, you know, directly, personally attacking critics of the Iraq war and the buildup, none of them lost jobs, right? They're still in think tanks. They're still, they would have taken over the Romney administration. They still float around in Democratic circles. So, like, that lack of transparency, which is super unnecessary, but also just like a general shaming of the elites when they screw up in a major way, I think that's also really important.
So how does this, I mean, give me your sense of how this, you know, how this winds its way. I mean, what should we be looking for in terms of this chipping away at that, and what needs to happen to chip away at that underpinnings of austerity? I mean, obviously, at this point, we're not going to see President Obama come on television tomorrow and say, hey, guys, this is a little bit embarrassing, and I'm speaking for, you know, a lot of the folks in the Senate. You know that whole thing about tightening the family's belts and us tightening our belts and whoops. You know, I mean, how does it do you think this is going to reverberate in the circles of power where it needs to? And how does that happen?
So it's important to understand what was actually disproven and what is off the table. What Rogoff and Reinhardt are now retreating from in their public statements is the idea that there's a cliff, right? If we get beyond a debt-to-GDP ratio, we're in a lot of trouble. They're essentially arguing to a much weaker, minor drop-off that I think a lot of people would concede, though there's not enough data to justify it. So that's really important, which means that there's no – if we try to take action while we have a weak economy, as we should – there's no other thing that's going to like sneak in and destroy the country. Now, obviously, in power, there's a lot of people who would really like an austerity agenda. They want to radically shift the balance of power from the poor to the rich. They would like to dismantle the federal social insurance network. They'd like to do other things as well, especially in Europe. So I don't think they're going to be dissuaded. I think hopefully people who think that maybe we were doing too much from 2008 to 2010 and then got really nervous about the deficit, we'll understand now that we didn't do enough. There's still plenty we could do. We could build infrastructure. We could reinstate the payroll tax. We could avoid the stupid sequestration. And that would not actually hurt us or put us in some sort of weird danger zone, but instead would be an appropriate response that would actually really rebuild the economy.
Yeah, we can only hope, I guess, at this point. But, Mike, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your piece, which has created really in in many circles, just a firestorm. You're basically translating this study, but it was fascinating to watch, and I hope it reverberates. And I just hope that we get to see somebody on a Sunday show mock somebody espousing this study by using the Excel spreadsheet. Some really good pithy phrase about it.
One can hope. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Mike. All right, folks. That is our the first half of the program today. In the better half, we will talk more about the what has taken place in Boston and the fallout from it. I just want to reiterate something that I think we said in the better half of the program yesterday, because we had just gotten reports to that. But the Saudi national, who was demonized in many of the creepiest quarters of the internet, particularly those Islamophobes on the right, who posted this guy's picture, who posted his name. I think Pam Geller went on to say, like, his name in English means sword. You know, I don't know if there has been a retraction or an apology in the New York Post. yes. I certainly can't imagine there's one over at the Islamophobe Central site. But that Saudi national whose home was, raided is the right word, but raided and in Revere, turns out to have been completely exonerated of any involvement other than as a victim. And we didn't get that official word until I think we went into the better half of the program, so I want to make that absolutely clear today. And we will talk more about that in the better half. Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. We could not do the show without the support of our members. We cannot grow this show. We cannot keep us all from burning out, frankly, without your support. We want to build the show and be able to expand our producer crew and even maybe upgrade one of these guys. Look at that. I don't even get a response. Michael's not even listening.
I could use a new processor.
Michael doesn't even know
what I'm talking about. A new chip in my body.
You said an upgrade for us.
I said maybe upgrade these guys.
Yes, we need upgrades. We're
upgrade,
old. We're
upgrade
old.
The producers.
I got that. No, sometimes I don't need to pay attention and acknowledge every penny.
All right, so you see what I'm dealing with here, folks. So it's your membership that is so crucial to this program. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Just click on the Become a Member and become a member. Very shortly, hopefully, we're going to have an app. I guess, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. And apparently, apps are very much like Rome. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link, buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's employee-owned. Everything's fair trade. Get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. Want to call this program? Be a part of it. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me. I am turning on the IM now. Apologies. At Majority FM. Or if you don't have AIM or whatever your client is, majority.fm@jabber.org. All right, see you in the better half.
Satan, I prepare.